published her first collection, At Home in the Dark, which was shortlisted for the Forward Prize. I'm just going to quote something I was rather taken with what she said about poetry. I'm interested in connections between personal experience and the world at large, the telescopic shift and slide of perspective that poetry can accomplish. Greta will read first, and then afterwards we'll be listening to David Hart, who is at the moment the Arts Council Poetry Fellow at Warwick. He's also one of those terrifying prize winners. He won first prize in the English National Poetry Competition and also in the Irish National Poetry Competition. He's written libretti, plays for Pub Theatre and BBC Radio. He's had poetry residencies at Worcester Cathedral, the Alderburg Poetry Festival, and South Birmingham Mental Health Trust. His collection of poetry is Setting the Poem to Words. And in 1998, he was the Birmingham Poet Laureate. One thing that he said about poetry that I was quite taken with and terrified by: the complexity of truth and beauty will never cease to be the truth for poets. And he's described poetry as discovery, indeed a research project, as mysterious as other languages, asking to be heard where medical and managerial languages tend to be louder. Before we carry on, I'd also like to say that this reading, along with all of our other readings, is now being advertised on Guardian Online. And they have a little form. If you go onto the Guardian Unlimited website, they have this listed, and then they let you, they ask at the end whether you loved it or loathed it. And so you can go on there, and we will all read what you say with interest and mark off all students down who say the wrong thing. I'll pass on to Greta now. Are you going to read up here?
I'll just see what it's like.
Is it best if I stand there?
Yeah. And can you all hear me? Yeah.
I'll stand here then.
Okay.
Good evening. I'm going to read 10 poems this evening. I'll begin with one called The Contract. It could be the way some women slip into minor when they sing their children to sleep. Or those baleful stories, night after night, whose soft iambics set the pace for dreams. That ensures a good handful of us will find ourselves at home in the dark, as if such subtle planting of love or tone could bloom into a shine from the light. Take this one here, who can't sleep, adrift in her room, surrounded by her things, the bed, chair, the empty shoe, the desk shaky on its heron legs, all cast now in the steely shades of a negative. And as she looks and learns to pass the time, something in her turns to a book so long unopened, her eyes will spring with tears. Or could it be at the age of 4, that first display that flipped the switch, the curved black acres, the hard little stars, that made this child no longer care for the seeable horizon, the bright seasons? Let's say it was for that one high arch perspective that she made the leap of faith before she learned to walk with reason. The next two poems, I'm going to stay in this child arena, if you like. This next one deals with rather lot of habits that I'm sure we all have, and some that are less easy to shake off than others, and I'm rather ashamed to say that I still possess the one that you'll hear about in this poem. The poem is called La Berceuse, which in French literally means she who rocks, and it's also French for lullaby. La Berceuse. I once had the power to wake and terrify small children, including myself, by finding I was rocking to and fro, banging my head against the pillow and moaning, sounds my parents learned to ignore as they sat and dozed, I like to think, in front of David Attenborough. That time he comes across a chimp, alone in a bruised clearing, his arms wrapped like cord around him, rocking on his haunches and whimpering. Classic runt behaviour, cooed the narration, pining for the arms of a mother grown weary of nursing, or dead. But I've seen it too, in wild prodigal children, hugging the movement like a wound, in men on the edge of chairs, beating the air in bright, stale rooms. I've seen it in the standard loony in B-movies and bad acting classes, in the bad lady and men on their knees, bending as if to drink from the page. Now, though rarer, it's enough to alarm a new lover as I sit bolt upright, my nest of hair. It's not so much a long story, I say, as one without beginning or end, but it's nothing, but something like the sway of woman, the shift from side to side of donkey and swaddled load plodding along the tide. Like the swing's slow subsidence when the child is out of sight, the sleeper on track beneath me, humming the night. At least the last line is not the Edinburgh suburb, as someone once thought it was. As I said, I'm going to stay in this childhood area for the next one, which I was trying to capture the way that children have a kind of unique and a unique angle on the world and on events that we as adults usually digest in a very different way. I was trying to recapture that, an event that happened. 100 sheep in a green field. The way our mother said something under her breath made us hush in the back and not ask why we'd slowed to barely a crawl, or why we were told to sit tight and everything's going to be all right. Our faces soon waxy with sweat, loomed out against the glass as we crept alongside cars where men alone in suits breathed in and out their own air-conditioned air. Slowly we came upon the scene. Under a big blue sky, the lovely smell of petrol rose in seething ribbons, and a woman in a torn summer dress was dragging her body across the lanes where bits of toy, car, family lay like the remains of a picnic, and a man's head lay sleeping on the wheel. room. Even the sheets smelt of coal. My sister sat at the window, closing and opening the curtain onto an empty, shiny field.
Ripped out floor, till I saw it moving so slow
dwelling in our hearts, it is beyond us. A cat jumps out, and before we know it, we're stealing back to my flat. The great thing, like a masterpiece in our hands, its surface anxious with knees and knuckles. The clenched line of your jaw and your lips kissing your own over and over with curses. You lean it so it catches the bed, and me, I nudge it with my toe so it won't hold my head. Switching off the light, my skin turns blue, and when you come in on the scene, we start to see ourselves like real professionals. And my head, disowned and free, watches what our bodies are doing, and somewhere the thought, I can't believe you weren't made for this. And I can't stop looking, even though the ache in my throat is growing, and soon there will be tears. And I can hear you looking, and I know what you're looking at, and it doesn't matter that it isn't me. You left me behind in a bar in Copenhagen Street. The one with the small red lamps hung, and my face 100 identical times along the wall, invoking, like some old speaking doll, the dissatisfaction I come back and back to. And there's this really pretty Chinese waitress you're trying not to look at as I'm talking to you. Then you get up and I'm left alone. So I lift my head to look at the man who's been staring at me since I walked in. He's huge and lonely and lifts his glass and nods. And all the women along the wall break into smiles. Then you're back and whispering. Your breasts, and your hands are scrambling up the wet stone of my back. And I imagine the lonely man is there, behind the silver screen, sipping his drink, his eyes thick and moist behind the glass. I know he's waiting to catch my eye, but I won't be seen to know I'm being watched, not till it's over. And we collapse, all of a sudden and awkward, and the room becomes itself again, filling the mirror with its things, and our two faces staring in, calm and dull and self-absorbed. And we look at each other, and are surprised, as if we weren't expecting to find the other here. And the look is quick, like a smile between two conspirators, returned to the world of daylight, birdsong, the good tug of guilt, before we tilt the mirror up, sky, heavenward.
What a break.
Came about from, you know, when you're on holiday or even when you live abroad, after you spent some time away. big dropped summer rain, and the iron smell of sperm that heaves off a certain shrub. My heart thumps obscurely at the thought of London, as if of a not quite forgotten lover, and the old song swell carries through the pitch, like the approach of a massive storm or myth. This next poem came out from I'm not the only one who enjoys making lists. I've been making lists since I was a small girl. I think one of the first lists was boys I hate. So he quickly changed to boys I love. It's been about a year. And I'm not based this poem, but there's something still there. It's called The List. Take it as read, then, that I lived and had a list of men the length of my arm, if you wrote each name small and neat, very. Like those they strain to fit on that thin cross on top of the hill, that no one sees except the man who walked his dog. I knew him once, and even he won't stop unless he's with his wife, who insists on reading every name and leaning to stroke the stone as if she might herself erase the lines of time and place. But heaven knows, it's only the wind up there, being salty and strong, that will, before long, return the stone to what it was, like the skin on my arm, smooth and clean, forgotten. Some of you Guardian readers in the audience, I'm sure. And Saturday Guardian in the magazine, there's a column there by Sylvie Williams called Words That Should Be Banned. Do you know the column? And I have one pet hate word, which is husband. So rather than light in the chair, in Sylvie Williams, I thought I'd husband is not a word I'd ever care to use for you. Oxen-like, it drags behind it others. Tillage, tie, stable, wife. Yoked beneath a double load of labour and love, it's stumbled into this century with so much baggage as if it meant to stay. And see how it pulls short a loose woman with a band that snags as often as it shines. But you, a farmer's son, are not inclined to ask too much of words. Casually, you shed the names of all the flowering grasses. But I'm of arty, liberal stock, the worst for seeking meaning that plainly isn't there. The book says puss, house, Rwandi inhabiting. So does he inhabit the house, or is he the house? The possibilities are endless and pointing to the same slam door. But I'll not hold you to a photo look, nor lay you under a stone of loving husband too. Still, I need you to come to the city tonight, to this rented room. I'll be up all night with a stick, a line that's come up clear and blue, a dot in position to rename you, my love, with one that will at least be true. turning, he took and he held it fast in his arms till it stopped.
Especially has made me wonder what the training is for a poet, what the preparation is. If you undertake a task of writing too, how do you train for it as you would for doing all sorts of other things? And I'm not sure, but it did make me write a sequence called Approaching. This is just a few bits of it. To stand and wait is to approach. To stand and wait in the particular place is to move. If I stand and wait in such silence as I can inhabit inside myself, some beginning of approach is possible. Where to look? Where to look outwards or inwards? Where to listen outwards or inwards? Where to touch and be touched? How to let go of all that I am and know, so as to stand and wait in such a way that approach is being done, is allowed, so that moving forward is in the standing still. And along with that, wondering what we bring to what we write, what we bring to what we do, but in this case to what we write, the baggage, the accumulated life that we bring. And this was a bit of that. I have brought the roads, the tracks, the paths. I have brought the sheep tracks. I have brought the small mountain roads. I have brought the muddy bridle paths, the steps through ancient woods. I have brought the field paths and the river banks. All these I have dragged in with me. And then more specifically, I grew up in Mid Wales. Even more specifically, in a church choir. I have brought with me, and the glory of the Lord, and Jesu, lover of my soul, and the Lord is my shepherd, and now thank we all our God. Far away are the woods are green. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, and out of the deep have I called unto thee. O praise God in his holiness. The trumpet shall sound. All flesh is as grass. Alleluia, and again alleluia, and more alleluia, alleluia, and more amens than I can count. All people that on earth do dwell as well, and we do not presume to come to this thy table, and our Father, thousands of those, ein Tard. In the beginning was the word, the goat went over the mountain, Lloyd George knew my father, and cum runda, bread of heaven, feed me. I'm going to work with some of you tomorrow on imaging and projection and scavenging and free association. And I've been experimenting with doing this in order to make these things called poems, like you would make a picture or a chair or a sonata. And I'm interested in trying to make the thing rather than the thing representing something else. This is one go at that. It is about 4 p.m, nothing much has been happening. A door has opened and closed. Some fine dust has been scattered. The queue I've been in, although snake-like, seems dead. It has no wriggling in it, no pulse. What's so special about time that we have to write today after yesterday, or March after January? Today I fell into a ditch because I was wondering what I was going to do tomorrow, while Auntie Edith thinks she's still 16 and will go for a swim in the sea, freezing at this time of year, thinking it is summer, because it is in summer that she stores her imagination. So I am waiting in this queue, knowing that tomorrow I will look back and, as the saying has it, kick myself because I wasted yesterday. I don't even know what the queue is for. But it's a queue that at any moment might come suddenly alive with anticipation. A door, the same door or another, might be thrown open and stay open. A rush of adrenaline will come rolling through the line. It will reach me. I will say, how wonderful to be alive today. Meanwhile, here's a poem. And if no door opens today, if tomorrow I wake with that dull ache of pointlessness and shame, and someone says, how are you today? I can say, look, I wrote this progressively through time. And smile, a big smile, and do a little swagger. Not too much, just enough. And this is very different. I only know I wrote this poem because it's in my computer folder called Poems. And I found it and I thought, this is strange. Where did this come from? But I did write it. Henry's photos. Do we still have the photos, Henry? You in the mirror in your underpants? You in the mirror doing party tricks without a party? Do let them see the photos, Henry. The faithful record, the invisible itch. Go on, dear, fetch them. The photos are all in order, aren't they, Henry? One season's nasturtiums, then the next, of the Christmas turkey, yearly. Show our good friends the photos, Henry, the coach station at dawn, and again as the sun set. Isn't the photos cupboard full yet, Henry? Show them the photo of the cupboard and the one of me standing by it in tears. Oh, don't be so terribly shy, Henry. Show them your pride and joy. Show them the one of the little bonfire. Show them the photo of the fire, dear, the one you nearly lit. When was that? That's rather bitter, isn't it? Where do they come from, those clients? I know where these came from, more or less, from my residency in for South Birmingham Mental Health, specifically from spending many afternoons, an afternoon a week, in one of the acute wards. And I was picking up what people were saying or doing. And this whole politics, the whole notion of how to be in such a place and be a writer, I think is unresolved. I feel very mixed feelings about it. And I don't think I wrote anything that I couldn't in some way identify with. Though, as I say, I was picking up from what I found there. I've been so bloody tired for a bloody long time. Tea's bloody cold, it's always the same. I come in here thirsty, and this is what I get. A teapot full of bloody tea that's certainly wet, but not hot. I'm seeing red, I want hot bloody tea. I've been so bloody tired, it's bloody being me. And the ambivalence of being at the edge. I would come out of the psychiatric hospital, get on the bus, and wonder about this sane world that was outside. And you do start to ask yourself, so where's sanity then? If this world, this weird world, that was the cue really for me. I thought this strange world we're in, could be a degree course, that the weird world. I'm addicted to the edge, call me back, call me back, call me back to the centre, let me go. I'm shivering in the wind, let me in, let me in, let me come into the warm, let me out. I think I've got a story, listen, listen please. Please listen to my story. Go away. I'm angry with the world. Calm me down, calm me down. Calm my whole body down. Just let me shout. I'm going to shout, I'm going to shout, I'm going to shout, shout, shout. I'm going to disappear at my own small voice. I want you to help me, and I want to carry on being edgy, being mad, being exactly who I am. Because I'm crazy, and I want to be crazy. Don't bore me with your cure. Don't tell me you're quite sure who I am, what I want, what I need to be. Just leave me at the edge, because I'm crazy, and I like it that way. I have absolutely no romantic illusions about mental illness or any other sort. It's not that. And it's not just metaphor. It is a sense of a relationship with this strange world we're in. Let me have a cup of tea and a cigarette and I'll write the poem. Here's the tea trolley now, and I've got a cigarette and I'll write the poem. Time out with a cup of tea and a nice long cigarette and I'll write the poem. The poem will come out right after a cup of tea and a cigarette. Just listen to this poem sing when I've had my tea and time in the smoke room. A cup of tea and a cigarette, then this will be the poem. Just wait. The smoke rooms are tiny rooms, I suppose on the basis that they're not going to be used, but actually that's where almost everybody is. So they must be the unhealthiest rooms on earth, the smoking rooms in the mental hospital. If I walk around in my blanket, I won't really have left my bed. If I walk around in my dreaming tent, I'll manage being half awake and protected. If I walk around in my blanket, the world won't open right up. It won't ambush me with its full light. I'm awake, but still in dark's lap. Halfway there is as much as I can bear. Not too much world and all that shit. So I come halfway to what's there. I walk around in my warm blanket. I was commissioned to spend a week on Bardsey Island off the Fyn Peninsula to write, and finished that with a book. I want to read just some from the opening. I didn't know how to write this when I was there, and since I grew up in Aberystwyth, on a clear day you can see Bardsey. Sometimes you can imagine you can see it, but I really think you can see it some days. And I always wanted to go there, and it was very strange to get off the boat and find it was real grass. It sounds silly now, but I somehow expected it to be different from the world, you see what I mean? It has that reputation of being a holy island and somewhere quite separate. But you get off the boat and there's sheep and there's grass and there's, you know, gates and houses. And I'd written a sequence in the voice of somebody I discovered because I saw the name written up on the fog station on Holyhead Mountain. And I wrote a sequence which is in my book. And I found the voice on Bardsey Island by speaking as the crag inspector again. With lots of hesitation, again trying to find a musical structure, I think, of some sort. When the dead in their nightshirts parade before us their unfinished lives, and on their long journey call back to us night after bleak night, and shadows lit through the windows, glowing warm, must be hallowed, with a candle kept lit shaking, and the welcoming hearth fed dried sap. The island is a woman waiting at the edge of the world. The sky is a trowel ready to scoop up souls when the woman sings to tell time to give them up. There is real grass here, real sheep, the sky I have known without windows, real clouds, stone walls, a track, a tractor, gates, real gulls, real swallows, real rocks, real sea, waves, butterflies, my own heart cranking, my old eyes in need of washing, specks of dirt on them, real grass, real rocks, real clouds being shaped and reshaped, real oyster catchers, real waves, real sheep, real gates, walks, walls, a track. People in their flesh walk the island, they chat and laugh, they grasp the island with their cameras. The stray mongrel that I am inspects crags, sings to himself fragments of old tunes and makes up new ones, goes back to his hut for tea when the dead on their journey. I see the visitors walking briskly, slowly, walking up the mountain, along the mountain, along all the northern, western and southern edges. I see them at the hides, on the grass, above the crags and bays. I see them up and down the track, between Tŷ Capel, Nant, Hendy and Plasbach, between Carrigbawr and Plasbach, walking, nothing to do but walk and sit and walk. And then they have gone. What are they? I worked on for years, trying to find it. It was as if it was there somewhere. And I couldn't find it. And I'm not sure I found it, but I stopped working on it once it was published. A Dance in Two Seasons. I saw you first on that long, frail summer evening, eating little at the picnic, but sliding away to hop and swirl and circumvent quietly alone. Some bold private writing was done then, for hope's sake. Nor have you ever spoken to me, except to whisper, name the grasses. I have seen the deep cut graves on the cliff top. The whole cliff is an open-mouthed skull. The whole world is skull, and the whole world's heart is in its stony mouth. Between trees giving way so empathetically as hardly to be seen at all, you laugh as if you know something. I see you now in what appears to be winter. seed pods lie broken open and crusty on the ground. You walk hardly protected against the wind. Slower, shriveled, impossible writing must be done now, for beauty's sake. The grasses are browning inside me. Quaking grass, woodrush, red fescue, the common reed, glaucous sedge, marum, bulrush, wild oat. These have become my own names, waving against each other for recognition. I have noticed the sky taking its cut of us, the whole sky promoting itself as if finite around us, so as to grasp and squeeze us. Between trees holding their ground, in the evening of a billion years, you abide and laugh as if you know nothing. O blessed homeless light. I go to I'm part of a network rather than a fixed group, the Border Poets that meets on the Shropshire Wales border. And last year we did a series of workshops taking our cue from not English writers from the last 100 years. And I chose to do a workshop based on Yehuda Amichai, the Israeli Jewish poet. And he died the week before the workshop. I'd actually written to him to see if he would just said send and told him I was doing this workshop, but he died. And shortly afterwards, a great Welsh poet died too. And I wrote this. Mr. Amichai, the world is full of people who are going to die, Mr. Amichai, and your turn has come. A blessing, I ask then, on your after-death journey. A blessing, I ask, on your memory. A thank you, too. A confused thank you. And it's all done, thank you. And I see you smiling and frowning at this. You've written all your poems now, and I'm adding this one. And you are saying, it's not necessary. It's not a good idea at all. Go and enjoy yourself. Go for a walk. Talk to the trees. Be ready for a surprise. Ask a blessing on all children. Don't hold me up with a poem. Let me go. And even as I'm working on this poem, R.S. too has gone. Did you ever meet? Did you read each other's poems? You can travel together, two old poets of uncertain temper, Jew and priest, Jerusalem and Jerusalem translated into Wales. And if you look back, if you will, bless us ambivalently, strangerize us, in the world still, writing still, still attending workshops, still thinking of our reputations, still trying to get it right, not yet dead, not yet taken by the sharp wind. And just a few poems from this book. A poem I've never understood quite, but it seems to have something to do with academia, I think. His wife drove him always. His wife drove him always. The impressionists had washed him out, had done for him altogether. He sometimes liked a cream tea if the drive was not too arduous, and she found it for him. The impressionists had done his head in. As he was driven, the memories came, a clotted scream, she would joke with friends after he'd died, after she'd last driven him, giving him always more impressions, laying his life out for them, escaped him. She drove him to the end always. No conversation clouded the journeys. She had learned to enjoy silence. He feared for his soul's peace beyond death. The thought of eternal impressionism terrified him. She laid her hand on his arm. She placed a leaf in his open hand, and she spoke its name, leaf, leaf. He woke as if from an amputation. His wife drove him always. They were in relationship. A miracle was not expected. She drove him quickly through mountains. When a gull flew overhead near the sea, she said nothing, nor at sunset. His wife drove him always. She was his ears and eyes. The impressionists had washed him clean out. Well, if you know what that's about, you can tell me afterwards. Sometimes a poem seems to be about something really interesting and even powerful, but you don't quite know what it is. And I think that's one of the purposes of poetry, to try and find things that you can't find in any other way. And that don't exhaust themselves. You know, you don't say it so it's said. You say it so it's still there to be found. This one too. Oh, strange animals that care in us. Strange, strong animals lie waiting for an end in us. Oh, dry animals that mourn in us. Coiled serpents are knotted in us. Rare butterflies look for flowers in us. Dear, dark animals stretch dying in us. Bats fly in circles in our caves. Oh, strange animals. Heal us. And finally, two short poems honouring two great makers of the language. William Tyndale, great translator of the Bible, was strangled, then burned at the stake, just north of Brussels, in 1536, for translating the Bible. And there is a letter in the British Library that he wrote from his cell. When I saw this, I'm not sure if you can find it published, very likely you can, but I saw it on display, his hand, in the British Library, and so came away with an impression of it and wrote it in my own words, but his too, as a poem. Please bring some socks. Please bring some socks, and if they can be smuggled in as well, the pens and the Hebrew Bible and the dictionary and paper. If God in his wisdom takes me for honour's sake, that is his will, but to die here of cold in my very bones fills me with dread. I am like piss in a gutter, draining away, unless your graciousness and courage save me. Smuggle in for me the socks, my friend, sir, and if you will, a thicker shirt than I have here, and a blanket. And the other one is Manly Hopkins, who never knew that we would love his poems. It's sobering to do a poetry reading and to publish a book and to feel, to know that Hopkins never had that. In his life, he died not knowing what his poems would ever mean to anybody. So this is a little fantasy. Father Hopkins, he's shy about his poems. So I went up to Father Hopkins after Mass, and I asked him, could I buy a book of your poems? He said, book? What book? I said, of your poems, Father. He looked at me, wondering, it seemed, if I was real, or whether at this early hour, fasting, he had imagined me. My book, he asked again. I said, yes, of your poems. He looked about him, then lowered himself onto a pew. Do you mean there is such a book? I said, I assumed there was. He said, ah, and was up and away, murmuring to himself some private invocation. Thank you.